Coming up on Tech Nation, we all know that teenagers and young adults are tied to their screens. What are they doing? How dangerous is it? And what can be done to protect them? Today I speak with Dr. Dan Reidenberg, Project Director for Safe Online Standards at the Mental Health Coalition. Then, is a vaccine for cancer just a pipe dream? I speak with Dr. Chris Peary from HDT Bio. Working with the National Cancer Institute and Johns Hopkins, he tells us how they're looking to do just that for prostate, breast, and even pancreatic cancer. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 2011, I interviewed Dr. Parag Khanna, an economist and the author of How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance. I noted that another economist had been a guest on Tech Nation. That would be Nobel laureate Dr. Mohamed Yunus. He believed that poverty need not exist. In fact, it would someday be in a museum as an artifact of how we used to live. I asked Parag Khanna, do you agree with him?
I do agree with him because it's not about money. Poverty is not about money. Poverty is about mechanisms. It's about needs. It's about having your basic Maslowian needs, shelter, water, food, these types of things, having those needs met. And we do have the resources to allow people, to empower them, to enable them to meet those needs.
Not give it to them, empower them.
And that's the big difference. Giving someone something is a one-off thing. That's how you help people. What I argue in this book is that you need to help people help themselves. Teach a man to fish. Very ancient principle, very obvious one as well. That's how you create a self-sustaining kind of system. That's how you allow local communities to be resilient. If poverty alleviation depends on having all of the resources in the World Bank and them allocating money whenever they have the attention to do so and whenever the money makes it through the fingers of bureaucrats, that's not resilience.
It's interesting as well as in hearing you describe this vision, because Dr. Yunus also said if you want to make all the nations equal on the health front, because don't forget, it's a very few countries who hold all the patents on the drugs. It's a very few countries who create a lot of this medical innovation, that you've got to be able to enable all the countries to create on a world-class scale. And then they're trading innovation, not just commodity.
And one of the things that the Gates Foundation is doing is actually training African universities to have centers that actually develop and produce low-cost seeds and pesticide-resistant strains of seeds and things like this. These are very important innovations that can be made, produced, manufactured in the developing world, in the poorer countries, and then they can also provide for themselves. So again, it's about mechanisms, not so much about money. So legal things like patent regulation, but also technological things. I mean, telemedicine, for example, allows doctors in Canada and the United States to deliver at least healthcare guidance and advice to patients in all over the world at almost no cost.
And on the face of it, it seems like a very simple notion. But let's take the African universities and researchers developing genetically modified seeds. At least six African countries refuse to have anything genetically modified, no matter how difficult it is, number one. And number two, we have the World Trade Organization saying, wait a minute, if you want to be a member, and many of them are not, then you've got to subscribe to our idea of what patents are all about. I mean, this is a you've got to do more than just create the innovation.
Well, you know, the World Trade Organization is a very important case study in the sense that it has been so important in the last 50, 60 years in promoting global trade and bringing down trade barriers and harmonizing regulations. World trade has expanded so astronomically since the end of World War II, and it owes itself largely, to a large degree, to the role of the World Trade Organization. But today, you haven't had progress in World Trade Organization negotiations, such as the Doha Development Round, for almost a decade. And yet, world trade is growing again tremendously. The reason is because countries want it. Everyone wants to be part of global trade. So even if you didn't have any more World Trade Organization breakthroughs ever for the rest of our lives, you would still have deepening, expanding global trade. You know what we're experiencing right now? We're experiencing the globalization of globalization. Because what we've called globalization has really only been 15 or 20 countries that represent 80 to 90% of world trade. We're expanding that circle now. Countries are getting involved. Brazil and Latin America are trading with Africa. China is trading with Africa. Asians are trading with Latin Americans. It's all globalizing now. And it's happening even without some kind of central arbiter mechanism like the WTO.
You've been listening to a 2011 TechNation interview with economist Dr. Parag Khanna about his book, How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance. He's written a number of books since then. The most recent was published in 2019, The Future is Asian, published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is TechNation. Today on TechNation, streaming, social media, massively multiplayer games. Dr. Dan Rydenberg talks about what young people are doing, how in some ways it's surprisingly good, and in others, unfortunately bad. Dr. Rydenberg is the project director for Safe Online Standards with the Mental Health Coalition. Then, Dr. Chris Peery, the co-founder and COO of HDT Bio, tells us what it takes to build a cancer vaccine and exactly how it's done. He'll fill us in on HDT Bio's efforts already underway.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Dr. Dan Rydenberg. Dr. Rydenberg, welcome to TechNation.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
Now, while the specter of social media looms large today in politics and in the financial markets, for all of us who are parents and even grandparents, social media is a completely new technology. And when it comes to raising our children to, you know, to teenagers and adulthood, what do we know about social media and its use and its impact on these, whether it's teenagers or young adults? Do we know anything?
Well, that's a complicated question, actually. Sure, we know some things, but there's a lot more that we don't know than we do know. We know that kids are spending a lot of time on social media. But actually, if you look at some of the studies, what it says is that when they're on social media or on their phones, per se, most of the time they're streaming television. Less of it is actual on social media the way that people think of as, you know, TikTok or Instagram, things like that. So we know that kids are using these screens and they're using them a lot of the time. Now, sometimes it's for good, sometimes it's not for good, and sometimes there's bad actors out there that get involved and really take kids down a rabbit hole. But we know that social media is really still a new phenomenon, really. If we think back, it's maybe 15 years of age, just about, that we've really seen this prevalence of it everywhere. And then when you add in the gaming aspect of it, that adds a whole new spectrum to this issue of social media. So we know the kids are using it. We know that for some people, but a small number of people, it is having a negative impact. And that isn't all of the time. It's only certain times over certain things. By and large, we know the kids are on it and they're seeing good and bad things on it.
Okay, so let's go into the gaming a bit. It's one thing to have your solitaire game, not connected to anything. But there are these massively multiplayer games, and who knows where these people are around the world. All these people are on it, and all this stuff is going on, a lot of it violent. Or at least somebody has to beat somebody else, and you've got this persona and all these things going on. There's a lot of people on these games.
There are a lot of people that are doing gaming today. And yes, while some of the games, many of the games actually have a lot of violence to them, the community that is built around these games is enormous. The support systems that are built around these games are enormous. The help that people have when they're playing these games and the connections they're making, are things that weren't being made before. And we know, research does tell us, that the more connected we are, the better off we are. It strengthens our resilience. It helps our mental health and our well-being. It reduces our risk of suicide. So these gaming platforms, while some of the games themselves are very violent in nature, the community that's built around them tends to be very, very positive.
So connection leads to health.
Absolutely. The more connected we are to things, the better off we are. Now, that can be connections to people, to games, to nature, to a faith. It can be connections to a lot of things. And one connection, one strong connection in your life can be a life-saving thing for people. Many connections can be even greater. It magnifies it. So the idea that people are being connected, not just through gaming, but through social media and all the technology, in particular around games, though, when there seems to be violence, there still seems to be this very positive outcome of how they're connected, way they can talk to each other, the support they can get from each other.
Well, there's much more to consider than social media and gaming. I mean, you're with the Mental Health Coalition. How is dealing with, supporting, or even recognizing a young person's or young adult's mental health different today than it's been in the past?
That's a really good question, because it is really different today. You know, historically, it was either a parent that thought something was wrong with one of their kids, or maybe a teacher in a school was really concerned about somebody academically or behaviorally at school. They identified that, maybe brought them to a counselor at the school, and then maybe even far less, but maybe they would bring them to a therapist in the community. Today, we see lots of people being identified in a lot of different ways. And sometimes it is actually online. Sometimes it is other people that are recognizing it. They report it. Sometimes it is people recognizing it in themselves online. They're going online, they're learning information about what might be going on for them, and then they're talking to somebody about it. So the way in which we're identifying whether there is a mental health challenge for a young person today is very different than it was before.
Now, when we were speaking before the interview, you were talking about this sort of what you called over-pathologized sense of what's going on here, in that these young people believe that any bad feeling may be a medical problem. And that's just life. You're going to have good feelings and bad feelings, right?
That is exactly right. This is something that I've been talking about for a while, that we are over-pathologizing people, not just young people, adults as well, but young people in particular. Young people don't tend to actually feel quite as bad as we think they feel. We project a lot of things on them, and we want to classify them. We want to categorize them. We want to try to put them in a bucket where they may not really actually fit into a bucket, which becomes a diagnosis. And this over-pathologizing of young people, I think, is really not very good. It's not very healthy. Oftentimes in life, there are just bad things that happen to us. There are sad things that happen to us. There are hard things that happen to us. And oftentimes those things are actually motivating. They help us learn. They help us grow. We have to figure out how to get through these difficult challenges in life. But when we over-pathologize, when we say that, well, you're depressed or you're anxious, well, you might be. That doesn't necessarily mean that you should get a diagnosis or that you need treatment for it, whether it's seeing a therapist or going on medications. Now, in some cases, it very well might be. But oftentimes, too often, today we are over-pathologizing young people, and we are putting them in this category where often I don't think that they really fit.
In fact, to that point, you were saying to me earlier, there's a difference between being safe and feeling safe. That makes all the difference.
Oh, that's exactly right. You might feel like you're safe. You need to be safe. And there's a big difference in that. If you're thinking that things are out of control in your life, or you're afraid for what might happen to you, then you need to do something about it. Whether you talk to somebody or you get some information about it, you call somebody, you talk to the person next to you. That's very different than everything's out of control and you don't know what to do. When that starts spinning inside of you and you don't reach out, you don't know who to talk to, you don't know how to get help, that's when that unsafe feeling really becomes problematic for people, when they don't know that they can control it any longer. Oftentimes we will hear people saying, well, I don't feel very safe right now. I don't feel very good. but they actually are more in control than they really think that they are. As long as they can check that out and know that they can do something about it, they're going to be okay.
Now, this is not just a U.S. problem or a problem for societies that have money. The World Health Organization counts mental disorders as part of the global burden of disease in this age group, some 13% in this age group. And by their definition, health includes can cope with the normal burdens of life. Well, hey, the normal burdens of life cause me to be uncomfortable on a daily basis, but a whole lot of other things. You know, it seems that we have to integrate not only what's going on and our better understanding and acceptance of mental disorders and mental function with all of this new technology. It's got to be brought together.
That's right. When we think about how you're functioning, it's in multiple areas of your life. It is socially, occupationally, educationally, legally, financially, in terms of relationships. It is all sorts of different dilemmas that we face in life. And on these different domains, if all of them start falling apart at once, or if multiple ones of them start falling apart at once, that's when we see a problem. Now, it has to last for a period of time. It's not just, well, if all of these areas fall apart for me for 2 or 3 days. No, you can imagine you lose a pet that you've had for 10 or 15 years, or a family member, you lose a family member. These things are going to be difficult on our well-being. That's going to tend to pass. And for young people, when they think about they failed a class, or they maybe didn't pass their driver's test, or maybe they got their first speeding ticket, or they broke up of a relationship that they really cared about, their first love. These things are going to pass. They become traumatic at the moment. They think that their life is in danger at the moment because what am I going to do? I thought I was going to spend my life with them. Well, the reality is in a couple of hours, a couple of days, those things tend to pass. But when we see them going on for a longer period of time, that's when we start seeing our mental health really become challenged. Now, what's happening today, where technology is folding into this, is that we're living our lives out online. In the past, it used to be in our little community, and really a very close community. Might be just our friend network, might be within a school. Today, that is global. We are not feeling well. We put something out on social media and the world can respond to it. This is where bullying can come into effect. This is where all kinds of support resources can come into effect. But technology can quickly magnify, amplify what's happening in our lives in ways that it didn't in the past. And so when it comes to mental health issues, we see somebody putting out that they're not feeling so great. Very quickly, we can get a response. Now, that doesn't mean it's pathological or needs treatment. It's just the world is coming around to support you, where in the past, it was just a local community that was doing that.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Dan Rydenberg. He's the project director for Safe Online Standards at the Mental Health Coalition. More information is available at mentalhealthcoalition.org/SOS. Well, Dr. Rydenberg, now we're exactly where all your work has been going in the last how many months, over a year, and that is in this area of safer social media. Before we get to the actual steps and phases that you've been working through, what's the big idea? What is the big perspective here for social media that you're working on?
I appreciate you asking this because this is something that came to me about a year and a half ago. And I started to think to myself, you know, we have ratings for lots of things, in particular movies. Parents know what movies are rated. Kids know what movies are rated. And yet we don't have that for technology. We don't know if you go onto one of the platforms, whether you're talking about Instagram or TikTok or Google or YouTube, any of these platforms, even a gaming platform, how do we know if it's safe? Or is it safer? Is it safe enough? There's no way to tell right now. So the idea came to me is, well, why don't we have a set of ratings for that? Well, to be able to get to ratings is a pretty complicated process. It takes a long time, takes a lot of people, takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of research, takes a lot of knowledge. And you have to start by having standards. So we came up with this idea of, could we build the first ever set of standards for online technology companies and take those standards and turn them into ratings so that there could be something very simple. If a young person went online, they opened up one of their apps and they said, oh, this is a safe place for me to be. That's kind of the big picture here, but there's a lot that goes behind that.
Well, that's where I guess it starts out a plan, and now you're executing that plan in phases. Let's talk about that. What is the journey you've set out on, and what are you planning to do, and where are you within it?
So there are a number of steps here that have been involved. We started by looking around the world at what was going on. We did a big ecosystem assessment analysis to find out what tech companies were doing around safety, to find out what experts thought about it, to find out what organizations were talking about. We looked around and what we found is that this was really truly a gap, that there wasn't anything like this. Once we did that, we started trying to figure out, how do you develop these kinds of standards? What are the best practices for that? What are the best practices for vetting experts? And how do you balance that out so you don't have just too many of one domain in an area, one discipline? After we did all of that, we came up with a roadmap, a three-year roadmap, with the first year was really building out what these standards could be. And I'll tell you more about that in a second. But year two would be, how do we pilot test them? And how do we actually find out if these standards could work? And then year three, going beyond where we started with new technology, new advancements in technology. We began this process by looking at youth, 13 to 24 years of age. People often ask me, why 13? Well, because most of these platforms, if you go on them, you have to be 13 to be on them. So we couldn't develop a standard, for example, for an 8 or a 10-year-old, when the platforms would say, well, kids aren't allowed on them. Even though they know kids are on them, technically and legally, they're not allowed to be. So we looked at 13 to 24 years of age as the starting place. We gathered experts from around the world in all different kinds of disciplines, not just technology, advertising, social media, youth development, adolescent development, research, all of these areas. And then we started doing focus groups. These focus groups really were to try to bring in every voice that we could. We wanted to hear from kids. We wanted to hear from parents and users of these platforms, what their thoughts were, what their concerns were, how they thought and saw safety online. So we did all of that. We did a big survey. And then we created this big matrix that looked at all of the things that people were saying around the world needed to be done. All the governments that were coming up with regulations, all the experts that were saying what needed to be done, including, for example, the U.S. Surgeon General in his advisory, the American Psychological Association in their advisory. We looked at all of these things and everything that we heard in these groups and from around the world. And what was amazing in this matrix was there was no consistency whatsoever. Nowhere could you find none. Nowhere in the world could you find people saying, do this and you are going to provide safer platforms in terms of technology for young people. That led us to bring together experts, again, from around the world, and start developing out what could be the first set of standards. We did that in December of last year. And then we moved into really the next phase of phase one was, could we get this approved for a study, an international study? And we did. We received Institutional Review Board study. And right now, the experts are going through this big Delphi process. So they're going online and they're looking at all the standards and they're saying, how important is this? Is this a little important? Is it really important? Is it essential? And we're using a data-driven approach to develop these standards. Now, at the same time as we're doing that, we have this open public comment period because we want this to be fully transparent. We want to hear as many voices as possible. So we have the public weighing in on this. We're doing more focus groups with young people from around the world telling us what do they think about these standards. And what we've found so far is that the standards really fall in five kind of bucket areas. These bucket areas are policy, governance, and transparency. Functionality, literally how do these sites and platforms function, content, and digital literacy and well-being. What was really interesting when we came to this understanding of, from this matrix that had no consistency and all this feedback from around the world, is that these five areas really mirrored some of the things that the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine came out with at the end of December in terms of what they believed to be a roadmap for getting safer online content. So where we're at now is, again, the experts are looking through everything. They're rating everything. They're going to score everything. That's a data-driven approach. We're hearing this open public comment period. And we're moving into testing. That'll happen in the next few months. Now, a couple of things I think are really important that people would want to know. They always ask, is technology involved in this and who's paying for this? Really important. Technology is not paying for this. This is all being funded by the Mental Health Coalition. So there's no outside financial influences, nor is there government influence either in that respect. There's no money coming in that way. Second, we have brought tech along with this. And why is that so important? Technology companies today are being overwhelmed with the regulations coming at them from around the world, case law that's coming at them from around the world. This is the only process that they have said, we think is really important, we think is valid, it's coming from a neutral place, it's bringing together experts from around the world, and it seems very balanced in terms of trying to provide online safety. So while they have no influence, no technology company has influence over the standards, I've kept them aware of what we're doing, and they have offered to pilot test this because we see tech here as not the enemy. We see tech as where kids are. That's where they're living their lives. We want it to be a safer environment for them. Part of that is on tech. No doubt about that. Tech can do more. They need to do more. And I think that they will with this kind of guidance. Part of it is on us. It is on us as parents, as caregivers, as educators, as healthcare providers, to be able to help kids understand how to use tech differently. That's all happening. And I would say in the next few months, we are going to have the first ever set of standards for online technology platforms.
Now, you mentioned these five primary areas, starting with policy, governance, and transparency, and they further break down to 30 recommended areas, which break down again to like 80 or 90 very specific substandards. And that's where I'd like to go, this most detailed level. Give us a few specific examples at that level, if you would, about what you might be looking at.
Sure. Here's an example. One of the standards has to do with reporting. And many kids, we just did a focus group with kids from around the country and in Canada last night, and they talked about reporting features online. They're worried about a friend, and they want to report that to the company so that the company can send them resources or the company can do something to help their friend. They never hear back. They never hear any feedback from the company about this. So one of the standards is, do you have a policy and a procedure on reporting around self-harm? That's a standard. The substandards would be, is it easy to find that? Do you provide feedback to the person who reported that? How quickly do you provide them the feedback on what's been done?
I'm speaking with Dr. Dan Rydenberg. He's the project director for Safe Online Standards at the Mental Health Coalition. We'll talk more after a break. Both Whole Tech Nation programs and biotech-only interviews are available wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, technation.com and biotechnation.com. In the second half of our show, Preventing Cancer, how recognizing your cancerous mutations enables your immune system to remove them. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Dr. Dan Rydenberg. He's the Project Director for Safe Online Standards at the Mental Health Coalition.
One of the standards is, do you have a policy and a procedure on reporting around self-harm? That's a standard. The substandards would be, is it easy to find that? Do you provide feedback to the person who reported that? How quickly do you provide them the feedback on what's been done? Here's another set of substandards around that. Do you also provide them with support, them with information on how they can talk to their friend? So these substandards are the things that kind of build on what the standard is and help guide the companies to be able to say, here's the kind of information you should be providing to provide a safer environment, not only to the people who might be in trouble, might be struggling with a mental health issue, struggling with thoughts of suicide or self-harm, but also to the people who are actually watching this, especially in live streams. They're watching this, they're hearing it, they're seeing it in videos. We want to provide support to them too. So those substandards really delve into the real details behind the standards.
Now, I'm trying to figure out who's going to rate these standards. Is it simply guidelines voluntarily for technology companies, or is there a separate body that will look at each of the voluntary participation or whatever you want to say? Who's doing what, and how do you find out what it is?
Yes, that's a great question. So one of the technology companies, if they want to have their standards be reviewed by these standards, they'll submit everything to us at the Mental Health Coalition. And then we will have a panel of experts from around the world. They will go through everything that's been submitted. Now, one thing that's always been asked to me is, well, they can just say that they're meeting the standard. They'll check a box and say, yes, we meet the standards. Well, no, we're actually going a bit further with all the companies. They will have to demonstrate how they meet the standards. So, for example, if there's a policy, they have to submit to us what the actual policy is. If there's a practice or a function, let's take a function. One of the functions on the sites is that there will be a standard is how do you go about learning about safety? How do you find that out? Where do you find that out? They will not just have to tell us that their site does that, but they'll actually have to show us screenshots and show us exactly the steps that somebody would have to take to be able to access that information. Or parental controls is another big area in the standards. It's not enough for a company just to say, yes, we have parental controls over this and this and this. They're going to have to actually demonstrate how the parents find those parental controls. How can they change those? How can they increase the setting to make it more sensitive for kids based on what they think their kids should be seeing? So they will actually submit all of that to us. So it's more than just checking a box, yes or no. We will have experts actually looking and coding and saying, yes, they really meet what the intention of this standard is.
Now, your phase three, your third part here, says sustain and expand. This isn't just a report. You're saying we need to go through with this globally from here forward and improve upon it as we go.
That is right. That is right. We can't just stop. We're going to have to continually evolve this. There's new technology that's always being developed. So we have to look at virtual reality. We're going to have to look at artificial intelligence and how that changes. We also really need to get into adults. While we started this process around 13 to 24 year olds, we really need to look at adults because there are a lot of adults, millions and millions, in fact, billions that are online every day, that they need protection as well. So while we started with young people, we want to expand this to adults. We want to expand it to newer technologies. We want this to evolve over time. As technology evolves, we want these standards to be iterative. They need to grow with the technology industry. So it's not just we meet them now and we're set to go. What that's going to mean is that every 2 years, a technology company, if they want to be approved again, they will have to resubmit every 2 years and say, what are they doing on the standards? Whether that is the existing standards or the new standards that the experts find need to be created.
Well, there's no doubt that we are at a crucial point now. As you were saying, countries all over the world are trying to figure out, what do we legislate? What don't we legislate? What do we say? How do we say? And the media companies and the technology companies are having to respond, okay, for you and for you and for you. And it seems to me that doing it this way takes it out of the need for a country to make laws and actually can make it universal, can make it global in nature.
That's a really fascinating point, because yes, in many ways, this is going to provide a neutral, expert-based, consensus, data-driven approach that governments can look at, businesses can look at, organizations can look at, parents can look at. It's really a neutral way in which we're trying to approach this very complicated topic without any undue influence. You know, unfortunately, sometimes in politics, there might be one person that looks at one set of research, but they don't look at the other set of research. So they just push one agenda item. In business, we might have one group saying, well, there's a financial implication for us here, so we have to be careful about that. This approach is very neutral. This approach is trying to be very balanced and say, what is it that we need for kids to be safe? How do we protect their mental health as they're online? And we want this to be something that others can use as a reference point. We want, whether it's governments around the world, whether there's accrediting bodies around the world, we want them to be able to look at this and say, this is one model that has data behind it, that experts are weighing in on, that are saying we've used a transparent process to come up with what is best in class. Nothing else like this exists in the world, but we're using the best approach possible to make use for everybody.
Right now, if you are a technology company, it's a free-for-all out there. It's the Wild West. It's what happens when you have serial number one of any technology. And of course, they're trying to make it sticky, and they're trying to get you to come back and stay and watch what you're doing, give you more. And if that's what you like, we have more for you. And technology can do that just blindly, just in the blink of an eye. It can give you all those things that appeal to you. I'm just thinking, could this, in fact, change how we develop technologies in the future that has yet to be born, if you will?
I hope so. I really hope so. I hope that as we look at some of the short-term, mid-term, and long-term outcomes, that is an outcome. That new technologies that are built, whether it's a new gaming platform, a new social media, a new search engine, and any kind of new technology, you'd be amazed at the kinds of inquiries that I'm getting around this that are not just around social media now. People are looking at this as saying, how can we use the standards that you're creating to develop new technologies that can make things safer for young people? And that's really exciting to me. So I think that as the technology companies that are in our existence now and that new technologies are being made, they look at these standards and they say, wow, we can build off of this to make something really healthy, very well-being minded. That's a pretty positive outcome long term. So not only are we going to hopefully see changes in how people are using technology today, how they're using these platforms, but new technologies and how they're developed will do that on its own.
It's almost like it's going hand in hand. Oh, can we make a new technology? And this is part of the sophistication that we as humans have learned between humans and technology.
Yes. Now, kind of interesting as you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, isn't that really AI? Really, this is all going to be just learned and that's going to be factored into this. I'm not sure about that. I had somebody talk to me just a couple of days ago, and they said, we have technology that if you're online, we can listen to your conversation and we can rate how anxious you are, how depressed you might be. And we can adapt what you're doing as a result of that. That's a pretty deep advancement. I don't think that these standards are going to do that as much as what they're going to do is they're going to say to the actual people who are developing the technologies, the new technologies, use these standards as a guideline. make sure you pay attention to these things as you create this, as you create new algorithms, as you create new platforms, as you create new ways for people to interact and live their lives online. Think about these things. That's how I hope the standards are built, far more so than is AI going to run all of this? I don't think so. I think there's going to be people developing new platforms, and they're going to use these standards in a very positive way.
Well, Dr. Rydenburg, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and see us again.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this and your interest in this. I hope to be able to come back to you and share some of the findings from what the standards come out to be, from when they start to get implemented by these technology companies. We hope to actually get them to them this year and see what the changes are, both long-term and short-term, with these standards. So I hope to be able to come back and share more of that information with all of you.
Well, we look forward to it. Thank you so much. My guest today is Dr. Dan Rydenburg. He's the Project Director for Safe Online Standards at the Mental Health Coalition. More information is available at mentalhealthcoalition.org/SOS. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Some of us live with the specter of cancer as a genetic inheritance, perhaps the famous mutations of BRCA1 and BRCA2. For others, it can simply be an undeniable family history. Others of us may only suspect past exposure to a myriad of toxins found in modern life. Regardless, what if your immune system could find and target those cancer cells and remove them? Dr. Chris Peary is the co-founder and COO of HDT Bio. Dr. Peary, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Maura.
When we talk about medicines and cancer, we generally think of treating a cancer that exists. But you're talking about preventing people from getting cancer in the first place. How does that work? How is that possible?
Well, we're all familiar with sort of classical vaccines, whether we got them when we were kids or we got them for our kids, or maybe even more recently in the pandemic, you got a vaccine. You know, all of these classical vaccines are focused on preventing infectious diseases like viruses or bacteria. But the principle is generally the same, that you're showing your immune system a part of that virus or bacteria and telling it what to look out for. Like, should you ever encounter that infectious disease? And when we think about trying to prevent cancer with vaccines, the principle is generally the same. And in fact, in that vein of infectious disease vaccines, we actually have a tremendous example of how one can prevent cancer using these tools in the form of Gardasil, which was originally developed as a vaccine for human papillomavirus. And upon its approval, was indicated principally for adolescent girls. But what we came to learn as we continued to adopt this vaccine was that we were actually able to prevent cervical cancers and other types of cancers that had long been associated with the HPV virus. And now the uses been really expanded even to adolescent and adult males as well. Because in some regions where the vaccine has been well adopted, we've seen almost the complete eradication of cervical cancers thanks to preventing a viral infection.
Well, it's sort of interesting to me. It's like you don't even have to know the link from how you get from the human papillomavirus to the cervical cancer. If, in fact, you just don't have the presence of the virus, you're not going to get the cancer.
Exactly right. And there are any number of other sort of viral associated diseases that we're now thinking about trying to prevent by going after the virus first and preventing the viral infection by vaccination.
Now, let me take a slightly different angle here, in that some women are born with the BRCA1 and or BRCA2 mutations, which make them more liable to breast or ovarian cancer. What would be the approach there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, all of us are born with these sort of predispositions, whether it's for cancer or some other type of disease. And so when we think about preventative care, and indeed vaccines are one of the greatest examples of preventative care, then, and we want to apply that to cancer vaccines, then we can look at both your inherited mutations like BRCA1 and BRCA2, or your acquired mutations that you sort of pick up just by living and breathing, or sometimes by environmental factors. And we can think about vaccinating against those types of mutations in order to prevent different types of diseases, including cancer. And when you know you think about those different types of mutations, whether inherited or acquired, there are many which are associated with a specific tissue type and or a specific cancer. And it's on those particular types of mutations that we want to focus when we think about developing cancer vaccines.
Well, if I think about the mRNA vaccines, which you mentioned with COVID, they were focused on the DNA of that spike protein on the COVID. So would you be focused on the BRCA1, BRCA2 mutations as an example?
Yeah, as an example of a cancer-associated mutation is exactly what we want to look at. However, we'll tend to focus on those subset of mutations that are specific to the tissue or tumor that you're sort of exhibiting or you're predisposed to. Now, the mRNA technology that, as you point out, arose during the pandemic really gives us a unique toolkit for being able to do this. You know, there's two features of mRNA technology that lend themselves to cancer vaccines. The first is the ability to get your body to express the mutant protein, because a lot of these mutant proteins are very difficult to manufacture. But if we can do it in your own cells, then it's all that much easier. And then the second is the speed of response. We saw that speed during the pandemic when we had a new virus we'd never seen before, and how quickly we were able to develop a new vaccine. The same is applicable when you think about vaccinating against tumor-specific antigens that are specific to your own, like a personalized cancer vaccine. And in that setting, it's really important to be able to sequence your cancer following a biopsy, for example, and then to encode those mutant proteins into an RNA and then vaccinate it with you. And then all of a sudden, your immune system is aware of your specific cancer wherever it is in your body. And so that when you combine those two things, it really opens up our ability to develop these new cancer vaccines.
So in that sense, there are many tools now to address how we might develop a cancer and to get in there early.
Yeah, absolutely. So more and more, we want to think about developing cancer vaccines that are truly preventative. So Gardasil, again, being a prime example, but now with these new tools, we can think about developing preventative cancer vaccines that adopt not only infectious disease proteins, but start to look at those inherited or predisposition type of mutations that are acquired or, say, lead you down the path towards a cancer before it actually ever becomes cancer.
Let's get down to exactly what HTT Bio is doing. I know you're working on prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer, and breast cancer. They're three separate programs. What are they doing? What's different between them? Where are they the same? Tell us about that.
Yeah, these programs were really born out of the success of HTT's early vaccine work, again, in infectious diseases. And what we learned from those clinical trials was that our vaccine platform had some really unique features in both safety and cellular immunity, which is an important feature for developing effective cancer vaccines. And so we established some collaborations with folks at the National Cancer Institute, at Johns Hopkins University, and at the University of Washington Cancer Vaccine Institute. And across those, we've been able to combine our vaccine platform with some very well-established cancer mutations that are found, as you point out, in either prostate, breast, or pancreatic cancers. Now, those candidate vaccines are still in preclinical development. But what we're seeing in terms of cellular immune responses in those preclinical studies are really compelling based on historical publications of correlations between those cellular immune responses and improvements in overall survival for cancer patients.
It's too much to ask, okay, great, we're going to give you a vaccine and check the next 20 years and see if you develop it. This is like not we're looking for now. So you're taking people already with the cancers of pancreatic, prostate, and breast, and you're seeing, let's give you these and see if we can detect an immune response. Did I get that right?
Well, we want folks ideally who have, yes, been diagnosed with those respective cancers, but have undergone, you know, sort of standard of care treatments and have been fortunate enough to find themselves in remission or cancer-free. And then we can come in and give them our vaccine and then monitor their progression or so-called disease-free survival. And, you know, it's a too common concern for cancer patients that they are going to relapse, that their cancer is going to come back, whether it's in the same tissue that they had the cancer originally, or if it metastasizes to some other tissue. And indeed, depending on the cancer type, you can have to wait many, many years to follow these patients and wait to see whether or not their cancer comes back and whether or not your cancer vaccine made any difference in the rate at which or the frequency at which it's coming back. So one of the things we'll do in early clinical trials is take blood samples and measure whether or not your immune system has mounted a cellular response against the very specific mutations that we've given to it in our vaccine. And depending on the magnitude of those cellular responses, we can have a very strong confidence as to whether or not those that immunity is now going to help prevent the cancer from coming back.
This is just so fascinating in so many ways because cancer seems huge. Obviously, it is huge. I'm not saying it's not. And for so many years, we thought there was breast cancer and then prostate cancer. These were all different cancers. Then we understood, oh, it's all one cancer. It just happens to be where it is in the body. But I feel like we're getting our arms wrapped around cancer and we're sort of backtracking and say, what causes it? And now we're finally at that place where we could have a vaccine or a set of vaccines that could prevent it in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, we had historically our clinical diagnoses in cancer so attached to the tissue in which it was arising that as we learn more and more about the underlying drivers for cancers, as you rightly point out, there are more commonalities than differences across some of these cancer types. And what that's empowering us to do, especially in the vaccine space, is to identify some of those commonalities and then to develop cancer vaccines that are, you know, perhaps cancer type specific, but not cancer type specific in the way that it's, oh, just breast cancer. It's really all cancers that carry that type of mutation. And this is true of going back all the way to our example of Gardasil, where indeed the earliest demonstrations of cancer prevention were in a cervical. But now we now also understand that this vaccination can help prevent head and neck cancers, for example. And so this awareness that we've been able to cultivate really has empowered a broader ability to develop cancer vaccine candidates that prevent broad cancer types.
So the more we understand about cancer, the better we're going to get.
Exactly.
Okay, now you're testing a lot of people, you're working with them, they've had various kinds of cancers. You're seeing, are we generating an immune response? Hopefully we're seeing better results in terms of relapse, if that's, you know, if that can be avoided or at least put out, you know, extended further. When are you going to know what? How do you decide that? How do you move forward with this?
Well, as I say, you know, we're going to measure the cellular immune responses early on. We do want to follow these patients and monitor their cancer or their rates of relapse. But ultimately, these products will have to move through a traditional drug development pathway. So phase one clinical trial, phase two clinical trial, and so on. But ultimately, the goal is to bring these to market initially in patients who are, as I say, already diagnosed with cancer and find themselves in remission. But what we want to do is developmentally move our way upstream in the development of cancer, because you know, we really want to be able to prevent you from ever getting cancer in the first place. The challenge there is that it often takes different types of mutations at the earliest stages of cancer versus the later. And so it will take fundamentally different vaccine candidates to operate in that truly preventative mode than it will for, you know, sort of prevention of relapse or metastases.
So an early cancer or a precancerous condition might have a different mutation profile than full-blown cancer.
Precisely.
And that's where it becomes a vaccine. So there's the early stuff, and that's what you got to figure out too.
Yeah, I mean, this remains a challenge to understand what are the set of mutations precancerously versus during the progression of the cancer, and when can we intervene with a vaccine to either help treat or prevent those cancers. And the expanding ability or availability of gene sequencing information across our entire population. You think about like 23andMe. If you've ever done 23andMe, you get this great profile of, you know, what are all the different types of predispositions you have? High blood pressure, diabetes, cancer, what you name it, right? Blonde hair, brown hair, and you know, all of these different things that you can learn from your genetic information. As we are able to watch more and more people and gather their genetic information as they grow older, which of course, you know, cancer generally a disease of aging, then we can see in, you know, specific spots of your genes where these mutations arise and then where ultimately you develop cancers. And it's by that sort of broader awareness that we're going to continue to improve upon diagnosing which mutations need to be vaccinated against to ultimately prevent those cancers.
You have a lot of work to do, Dr. Perry.
I think we all do. We're all hard at work trying to improve these vaccines and all of the different diseases that we can prevent using them.
Well, Dr. Perry, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope you come back. Keep us updated.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'd be happy to.
Dr. Chris Perry is the co-founder and COO of HDT Bio. More information is available on the web at hdt.bio. That's hdt.bio. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment, Biotech Nation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.